Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome to Goalie Science, the podcast that bridges the gap between goaltending, science, and peak performance. I'm your host, Jamie Phillips, a former professional goalie, currently pursuing a doctorate in physical therapy and specializing in goalie performance coaching. Joining me as always is Dr. Ben Cernik, a seasoned goalie coach and sports analytics specialist. Whether you find yourself at home, on the road, or at the rink, grab a cup of your favorite beverage and let's drop the puck on this week's episode.
Jimmy, we're back. Most important question over my one shoulder. This is immediately good podcast. Classic. Sorry, my microphone disconnected there. Hot start to the podcast. We're back. Jamie's not going to cut that. So hi, everyone. Thanks for dealing with the first thing.
I'm definitely not going to cut that.
No, not being cut. Over my shoulder, Jamie, do you see my Joseph Wall jersey that I got for my birthday? It's like...
Who got you?
By the way, the best gift giver of all time.
That's pretty funny.
I never met someone who's better at gifts than my brother. He's dynamite. He's got the jam.
When was your birthday? I missed it. I feel like a bad podcast host and friend.
Yeah, it was like a full month ago. It's fine.
Ah, well, there you go. Well, everyone go comment on Ben's recent post. Happy birthday, Ben.
Yeah, thanks.
So Joseph Wall jersey and his return to the NHL. Played well, though.
He won that first game against Arizona, and then back-to-back home-and-home with Boston. And you know what? The important thing is he tried his best. So
I thought he played pretty decent. I don't know. I'm at the point in my life where I just give, like, everyone's just getting the benefit of the doubt. I'm like, they tried. They look pretty good.
This is funny, is the person who gets given a really hard time about always talking about the advanced stats behind things. I haven't watched the games. I didn't look at the numbers of the games. I did just see the shots and the goals, and I'm like, 850 save percentage, brutal.
Yeah.
Without, obviously, again, no context. I have no idea how
you don't need
even
context.
Even the person, myself, advocates to look deeper, took one peripheral glance and went, oh. So I'm as guilty as everyone else.
Send him back to the American League.
Yeah, back down. Go back down there.
Back down. Ben, let's get right after today. So the issue that I'm having, and it's more of me kicking myself in the butt because the season ended and the playoffs have ended for a lot of teams. Tryouts are coming up soon. But I mean, my role with team play and stuff was very small this year. I wasn't involved like I was at Michigan Tech or anything. Hopefully that grows. But I found out the day before semifinals for some of my AAA teams that the coach wasn't telling them who was starting until like warm-up time.
Hell yeah.
And my first reaction was that's still a thing. Because that was around, but that was like when we were younger, that was just like that happened. And people kind of were just like, But now knowing what we know about everything and mental health and mental performance and athletic performance and how these things are intertwined and preparation, I just couldn't believe that was still ongoing. And so for me, I'm kicking myself for not asking them like at the start of the season, like what the plan was. So that's my fault. And I take responsibility for that because I just assumed it didn't happen. But I just remember, like, I remember some of the dumbest excuses back when we played for why coaches would do that.
Got to see who warms up better.
Yeah, yeah. Who warms up better? Well,
in the 3 or 5 minute warm up, yeah.
4 to 5 minute warm up. Like, you're not just splitting that. There was also like, well, I want you guys both to be ready.
No, I hate that.
No,
hate that.
Like, it had that. Yeah, it's like, you should be ready to go in case something goes wrong.
Mm-mm. Can't do that. I think I've said this before. Now, again, for people listening and people who should know this, I like to consider myself a veteran college backup goalie. I spent 2 seasons of college hockey being firmly planted on the bench as a number two, which is fine. That is the reality of being a goalie. But it is, speaking from experience, and then anyone who's experienced any backup time in their life, to try and be mentally prepared throughout an entire game when nothing is happening to you is, you can't, I don't know anyone who can do it. And I think, and again, I don't know anyone who's ever done it, to be honest. Have you ever run anyone in your playing time that did that? Who was like ready to go the whole time while sitting on the bench with a towel wrapped around their neck?
No, it's not. The thing is too, is it's actually not sustainable. Like it sounds crazy as it is, but I'm just going to go based off of professional hockey. You know, we played around 60, over 60, between 60 to 80 games, somewhere between there, depending on the league that you're in. And to be mentally prepared that, like, and you, let's just say you break it up and you play 50-50, but to be mentally dialed that many days, especially when there are back-to-backs and there are 3-and-3s and 4-and-5s, it's not sustainable mentally for anybody, goalies or players. And no. It's the reason, if anyone's listening that's near East Coast Hockey League team, they play 4-and-5s. Actually, if you're in lower leagues, sometimes they play 4-and-4s, which should actually be a federal crime. But if you go to the first game versus the last game, there is, or even the middle game, there's a massive difference in terms of play, in terms of energy, in terms of excitement. It's just because you can't be that dial all the time. Ben, you're going to talk about cognitive load and something you've looked at in studies. And we did a brief little review and we couldn't find anything because, and you'll get into the nitty gritty about why it's difficult to measure. But anyone who's ever played, you know that feeling of prepping for a game, you know, the nerves, the excitement, the anxiety, and then the game being over and it's like, I can't sleep. I'm exhausted. And you wake up the next morning and you're like, you almost, for those that are old enough to drink, you almost feel hungover to a degree. And for those that are not old enough to drink, it's like you wake up and it's like you just had a really bad night's sleep and yeah. You're groggy and everything's, and like, and that's just because you've expended so much mental energy
and physical.
We're not going to get into, we don't have to get into the neurochemical part and all that stuff and how those things are replenished and et cetera, et cetera. But imagine, so you're already exhausted now and you're playing half the games. Now you have to double that mental load. It's just so ridiculous. And so like my recommendation is, I always tell coaches, like, you got to give the players like 24 hours in advance. That way the goalie that's not playing can honestly kind of relax a little bit. They're going to be frustrated. They're going to be upset. It gives them time to deal with that, but it allows them to kind of decompress and they can actually, they can use that time as mental recovery because maybe they know they're going to play another game in the future. And so they're going to be more mentally ready than if they were completely dialed in for a Friday game and then they have to play Saturday after backing up. And like, and then if you're a starting goalie or whatever level you're playing at, like, that's like, you need that rest time. Like, you're competitive. And if you're the starter and you know you're a star, you know you're the best, you're playing the most amount of games. Like, I used to look forward to sometimes having a day off. Like, it was nice for me to show up to the rink and not have to go through my long, arduous pregame routine that was way too long and way too mentally exhausting and play Super Bowl with the guys and have a lap and not. Yeah. And then, you know, if things started to go south early in the game and you know, like, yeah, there's a chance I'm going to go in, then you start to perk up a little bit and you pay a bit more attention. Otherwise, you're just there to kind of be a good teammate, support the guys, and just take that as a rest. And so for, I don't know where I was going on this, I got off track by quite a bit. It's just one of those things that I thought died out, and I guess it's still alive and well, and that's just so frustrating.
Yeah, so I think like one, like the starting goalie who knows they're going to play even the day before, they're already going to have those nerves, those, you know, the natural like pregame anxieties that most people get when they're getting ready for a game, something they care about. Obviously, all people deal with it differently and how they handle it differently. But, you know, I'd say most often than not, when you're preparing for a game, especially as a goalie, you know, you're building up to it. So adding that layer of uncertainty to already a pretty stressful situation, it's just not necessary. Like, you can avoid that pretty easily. I just don't think you ever need to do it. Like, I think you can always tell your goalies well in advance who's playing. Like, I am going to say something here. It's not supported by data. It is entirely a personal opinion. But if I think you're a coach setting a lineup, I mean, in minor hockey, you're not really setting a lineup. But so in minor hockey, like you can tell the goalie the day before he's playing. Like you probably know. Like you're really you really shouldn't be on the fence that hard about
it. For the most part, you're also in minor hockey, you're just like splitting 50-50. So if you're, say, you're one of those teams that doesn't, which would be weird, but, or if you're like the semifinal and final, the best.
Yeah, we're going to do it. We're going to do the 45-45-10 split or whatever.
Or just, you can also just text the parents.
Yep. Just let them know.
Just quick text. You have their numbers. You have their, I said, little Jimmy here.
Most teams use TeamSnap or some other group messaging service or organization service at this point anyway, right? Like, I think that's something that we can just move forward. We can just set our lineup, our goalies. Like, you can just do it the day before. It will help that goalie. It'll be helpful to the starting goalie. They'll have one extra less layer of, or one less layer of stress. It'll be helpful for the backup goalie, who's not going to go into that day all like wiry and jittery about that situation as well, right? It's just, you're reducing the overall stress in your team environment by a whole bunch by being just a little bit more planned, right?
You're making it easier on both goalies.
Yeah, 100%
different angles. You're taking out the unknown, so that goalie can go through their routine with that, that laser-like focus is all coaches want, just be to prepare. And then that other goalie may be disappointed, has some time to decompress, to reflect, to be like, okay, but I might be going Saturday or Sunday, and that's it. And now they have something of motivation, and they don't have to have all that stress. And then say you do need to use that goalie. Now you're getting a goalie who isn't mentally drained as a backup, coming in as a backup.
Yep. Yeah. I think this is a bigger picture on communication with goalies in general, which is just understanding and like clearly defining expectations for your goalie and for your goalies. I think sometimes coaches assume that goalies just think something. Like, for example, I know that in college, and you dealt with this a little bit too, but it's not always clear. In college, sometimes teams hold three goalies, so three goalies will dress for a game. In your first couple of years when you were dressing three, because back then there was, at Michigan Tech in your early days, like everyone sort of played. Like there wasn't like a clear, like, I think I remember your first couple of years, like there was 20 games played by one goalie, 12 by another, 10 by, like there was a lot of game splitting at Tech your first couple of years.
And I was getting none of them.
Well, you were getting some, just not.
I was getting four.
Well, but the point being, like, was there a clear line of communication each game? Like, hey, if this goalie gets pulled, you're not going in, or you're going in. Did you have that at Tech?
No. So it was just like, it was weird. At the start, there was like an obvious pecking rule where I was number three.
Yeah.
But then like, as things started to go along,
Phoenix started playing more, right?
Play starts playing more. Janot started playing less, and I started getting more relief. And it just, you just didn't know what you were going to get.
Yeah, you don't know where you stand, right? So I say this, I bring this up because when I was playing in the States, again, we dressed three goalies. I was a freshman and we had two juniors. So two third-year goalies, and I was the rookie. And so the first time I got put in the game, I didn't know it was going to be me, right? Like, I was like, in my head, I was like, oh, I'm the third goalie. I'm the new person, right? Because that just like wasn't ever like really made clear to me. And again, sometimes I think coaches, and I've heard this multiple times this year, coaches like forget that goalies are part of the team. And I know that sounds terrible, but they just forget that like that sort of thing matters, where that sort of thing isn't commonly known. Like there isn't like a clear order. So you shouldn't tell your goalies that. I mean, again, obviously most goalies listening to this probably aren't dealing with a three dress goalie situation, but it's examples like that that highlight these things exist, right?
And some team, like I said, I assumed it wasn't happening because a lot of times the teams I was coming across, everyone knew.
Yeah.
Another one of my teams, they're just like, oh yeah, we just we rotate consistently. So we always know he's flying. Then no one needs to decide. We're just 50-50 split.
Which is great. I mean, like, super simple,
and
awesome.
And it's like super simple. You don't have to. Actually, one of my, I was in the East Coast of Florida. Like, that's what we did.
You really?
Both goalies are contracted goalies, right? So
yeah.
Both are decent. There's a vested interest in them developing. And fortunately, yeah. The situation got a little murky for me because Carolina had 77 goalies. And it was just like the worst possible. Now I think back and I'm like, man, I got some really short ends of the sticks. But the coach there was like, you know, you guys are both signed goalies. You guys both, the teams have spent money to get you here. And you guys are both goalie. You can still play. So we're just going to split you. And they, they're going to give your team a chance. And if for some reason we want one guy to play over the other, we'll let you know.
And I think that's probably the right way to do it at the professional level in the East Coast. I think ultimately, unless you have like a 21-year-old goalie who you're like, nah, we want them to play 50 games.
You'll have an NHL guy on a team, and then you'll have a guy who's on an East Coast deal.
And then that
point. The NHL, but those Coast teams want to win too. So it's not like a lot of those times those teams will play. Like when I was in Jacksonville, like I backed up a guy who was, and I was on an NHL deal, and I backed up a little bit because I was just playing horrible, and that's just how it goes. But the almost the benefit of the doubt, or that first opportunity and second opportunities, usually come to the contracted guy, because that's the whole point of having affiliates, is use that ice to develop your goalies. Does development actually work? Well, I don't know. If you don't see a goalie coach for 4 months and then all of a sudden you get called up, then it's
hard to say. Yeah. Well, ultimately, I think what this comes down to, whether it's minor hockey, it's junior hockey, like just communicate to your goalies early on. Like, don't wait. They will not play better. You're not going to inspire them by not telling them. I will promise you that. If it's like an inspiration tactic, if it's a scare tactic, whatever the approach you're doing, as a coach there, or it doesn't work. Don't do it.
It's just kind of like Ingots here. It would be like, if you're at, I'm assuming non goalie oriented head coaches do not listen to this podcast, but if they do, it'd be like imagine telling all your players and they don't know their lines until like the first drop of the puck.
Like, it's not great.
They probably know, like, going to warmups, that who's playing with who. Instead, it's just like, nah, like you're just not playing.
So I think that's like ties into a really nice transition period where I think we need to just, this is going to be a shocking statement, I think, Jimmy. Goalies are not like defenders, and defenders are not always like forwards. Like, there is a requisite difference and like a required mental and physical difference to each position, right?
Dare you say something so bold.
So bold. Well, I mean, so again, this ties into some of the work that we did in my thesis. That looked at positional differences, and we looked at practice. But we looked at positional differences in forwards and D and goalies, and tied it to other studies that have looked at other metrics. But when we're looking at like cognitive difficulty, like aerobic capacity difficulty, leg muscle difficulty, we took like a bunch of different forms of difficulty during training. And like we found in our study, the goalies were massively different than players, like not even remotely close. So goalies had a massively different like technical experience during practice. We actually found that they had a lower technical demand in practice. But, you know, we've all been in practices where the technical demand is not so high for goalies.
You're telling me that just taking flow shots from the bottom of the hash marks, where you just don't go down because it's not even worth it, isn't technically demanding?
I'm saying that.
5 minutes?
I'm saying that. Exactly that.
Like, you're just breaking the mold today with these hot takes.
You know what they say? I'm tooting my own horn here, but these are all things we think as goalie people and hockey people.
And you can prove them.
It was nice to quantify it. Yeah, exactly. That's the whole point. Like, it was nice to actually show it and quantify it. And so those results will be presented at a conference in June in New Orleans. So sit everyone there. You can come see all the results.
Big hockey hot setting.
Yeah. Yeah. Right in Louisiana, we're going to be doing some talks about hockey. Presenting two posters there. See everyone there. I know you're excited for my hockey takes. But the point is, we found that in practice, goalies obviously had this massively different experience than forwards and D. Shouldn't surprise anyone. But when you look at previous studies, so our study, we found that goalies had like an easier time than players overall. When you look at other studies that looked more just at games, those studies find that goalies have a way harder time in games than players. So we have this weird imbalance maybe going on. And I think, again, as goalie people, as coaches, Jamie, I think that makes sense to us.
Yeah.
Where you can go through these practice periods, your team's doing system for 45 minutes and you're just skating around your net doing nothing.
And then I honestly, like, I like, because it gives that balance of the week leading off of practice isn't so mentally and physically, well, physically it's pretty taxing, but it's not so mentally taxing that you're completely burnt out for the game.
Yeah, and you shouldn't be. And there's like the thing is, there's probably a healthy balance of mentally taxing, though. So like, you probably want your practices, especially from a goalie perspective, to be have decision making as a goalie.
Be challenging. Yeah, it should be challenging.
It should be mentally stimulating, right?
Yeah.
So what I think is, I'd agree in a sense that, I mean, if someone should look at this in their PhD, holy cow.
I am not going back to school.
Well, that was a joke about me.
But the thought of me doing more school, it makes me want to vomit. I have 6 weeks left and I already want to vomit.
Well, I have four more years. But the point being, there's probably like a healthy balance here, right? Where practice needs to be hard enough that you're still like physically improving. Like, think about working out, right? You can't just like not really work out hard and then expect to make the same amount of gains as if you were training smarter. So there's probably some level of that, but there's definitely the same thing to be said about that technical, that mental demand, right? Like, the reason a 3-on-1 drill is harder for a goalie than a flow drill is because there's options and you have to read and understand those options, right? So you need to be training the mental side on the ice, like the cognitive, the psychological side on the ice, by having that stimulating, challenging part, those decision making things. What should not be mentally challenging is the conversations we have with our goalies and the right. So like this, you had mentioned this topic before. Is this maybe my transition piece? You'd mentioned this before about things and ways that like we just like shouldn't do as coaches with goalies. And I got a take for you. I think something that we should actually consider with goalies in practice, but also in it ties into games, is like how hard your drill is for your goalies compared to your play.
Yeah. Like, that goes both ways. Yeah. That goes between like a
two-neutral easy.
Doing neutral zone forecheck, like, so boring. And like, yeah, for a goalie, like, you can go and do edge work, but also like you're kind of tired. But then you quickly transition into like a 2-on-0, 3-on-2 below the goal line,
like a smaller area game,
where your goalie just gets roasted.
Yeah, give him a break.
So exhausting, and then it's like, oh, let's just do power play. We take a lot, and as Ben and myself are you know, strength coaches and stuff too. So we have that basis, and the way like we kind of look at it is through a lens of just general periodization and like workout progression. You know, when you're writing a workout program, you have the most technical and most neurologically demanding things first.
Yep.
When you're fresh. And then you have your quote unquote hypertrophy or like accessory stuff. That's stuff that doesn't require as much technical effort towards the end as you are getting fatigued. However, like you just see like power play, the time you really want to be dialed.
It should be
thing you're doing, you know, like, and that's just, it's just crazy because it's one of those things that's like, oh, we just always done it that way. So, no, like get a quick little warm up, get a sweat. Okay. Let's do some power play. Let's do drill. Just do power play. The best teams that I've been on, that was their structure is you do like a warm up drill. So it'd be like usually can of the cup, classic drill.
Classic.
Just get some shots and then power play and then do a drill and power play. And then do a drill, and then it's like small area game or power play, and then you're done.
Yeah, and so like this is actually, Jay, this is a really wonderful point because that's something that I admittedly have not put a ton of thought into, which is this idea of even within that practice, what's the order of things we do? I mean, I've been pretty vocal about the fact that we do way too much flow, just way, way, way too much flow in hockey, like period. Like you don't, flow drills are what we call, like they're linear, right? Go here, do here. Like it's just an order of things. There's no thinking at all. The mental load is zero, right? And like from our study, like we also found in the end, just talking to the people too, like those practices where you're like working hard on systems work and plays where there's tons of decision-making, you have to react quickly. That's mentally tiring, right? Imagine you do 45 minutes of flow, 2-on-1s, 3-on-2s, continuous back check drills. And then you're like, all right, here's the hardest thing you're going to do. right? And you should do some of that because that's how a game works. You're going to be tired at the end of games too, but you should be maximizing that time. And I think the way to maximize that is like just do less flow, make stuff.
It's also not good to players too. No, like your players are fatigued as well.
Yeah.
And again, you can do it, but especially if you're going to work on new technical stuff.
Yep.
Take advantage of that while your players are fresh and they're prime. They're going to be able to learn and absorb. And then you can do, you can do that space learning or like repetition based learning, where you practice something and then you can do something that's a little less cognitively stressful and then go back and then see like how much did they retain? Are they able to reimplement? Okay, no, we have to adjust. And then it's just better overall. And I think like, there's a reason that high level professional athletics, not just hockey, they employ people like Ben who look at this stuff because their jobs, they're the nerds and they're the ones that come up. They're the ones that prove and come up with ideas, and then people will go in and apply it, and they'll be able to adjust. Was the season successful? Yes. Okay. Good. Keep up. No. What needs to change? Did we mess up? Is the data, did data not match up the players? And so that's why these things exist. It's hard at a minor hockey level. Yeah. Because in minor hockey and young hockey, it relies on the information provided from the top leagues and the leagues with money to support them. But again, it's also different. You play in the NHL, you play 82 games, your practices are 20 minutes, 30 minutes, 45 are the very longest during the season because guys are tired and they're also the best in the world. Mm-hmm. So they don't need to learn skills. They already have those skills. They just need to move their body.
Yeah, there's like a philosophy in the motor learning world, and this is a paper from Nikki Hodges, but there's like three types of training. It's like training to learn, training to transfer, and training to maintain. And so like in season, like in the playoffs, you should be doing like a lot of training to maintain on like a skills level, right? Where you're not trying to necessarily like learn have these super mega hard practices and things because you're just trying to stay fresh and sharp because you're using all that energy in games, right?
Yeah.
Like, and that makes sense. But again, there's definitely time and place where you want to make that more challenging. Jimmy, I want to kind of keep going on the actual vein of the topic today. And I'm actually going to throw a question at you, which is now looking at your career, now looking at yourself now as a coach and as an almost doctor of physical therapy, how do you feel now about bag skating, skating for punishment? How do you feel about it?
As an almost doctor of physical therapy, I'll give you my favorite answer of all time.
Don't say it depends.
No, it depends. No, it depends. Give me some context.
Let me preface this by saying that skating for punishment or exercise for punishment is like a no-no in safe sport. So like the governing supervising body that says like how we should coach kids and how it says like you probably should not punish the kids with exercise.
You're telling me that I have never seen anything enforced ever. So good job, safe sport. I said it, but
you said it, not me.
Better didn't say it.
Thank you.
I do think there's a time and place for it, not really as punishment, but more as conditioning. But I do think there are ways to quote unquote punish or offer some incentive that isn't just bag skating. Like if your team didn't work hard and you want them to, your team lost the game pretty poorly and you want to quote unquote punish them, you can do just like small area bagger games because they will get skills out of that, but they're also so exhausting.
So tired.
Yes. Like going man on man with someone for 30 minutes, so tired. And you get, but the thing is, it's more the spectacle.
Exactly.
And that's what they're trying. They're sending a message.
Right, right.
And so send a message by just having like a 4-hour video where you go over every game that you're just like, just rewind. Like you just, instead of like, just like ruining your guys or girls' hips,
Yeah.
Like,
so when I played in college, our coach was pretty funny in the sense that there would be like rules for like the practice, and there's like very strict rules and some are a little bit more lenient. But one thing they would do is they would just throw you off the ice. Like so quick, such a quick hook that you're just like, nope, you're done. Like you're done practicing.
I've been a part of that and been a part of that in coaches. And it's not because it's like safe sport rules. It's just because you guys are bad today. Go home. Mind you, I actually,
but like, I didn't mean to do that.
Like,
hold on.
Oh, boom. I didn't throw players.
But like just for a player, like
Oh, yeah.
One person, you're out of here.
Even last week for me, so I do my Sunday skates for the organization. I had two goalies out, and they were exhausted.
And they were bad.
And so I was trying, and they weren't giving a ton of effort, and they weren't getting out of it. So, like, after 45 minutes, instead of using that last 15, I was like, look, we weren't very good today, and that's okay. Yeah. It's okay, but I want you guys to identify when things are not going well. If you're tired, you need to tell me these things in advance so that I can modify drills or we can adjust and change it. I said, like, just we're done. Like, we're going home.
Yeah, we're out of here. So I agree with that. The reason I asked about the bag skating thing is I've been to we're like in playoffs here in Ontario. Like, some teams are kind of done, like you are, like your teams are. Other teams are still going because playoffs last an eternity sometimes.
So long.
So long. So unnecessarily long. We could definitely do this better.
That's what the NHL team does.
Oh.
And we need to treat our 11-year-olds like we treat NHL players.
I had a team I worked with who had 14 games in 18 days.
I actually think about that. And I do laugh because, like, the thought, like, after playing, you know, years of pro, years of college and junior, the thought of me, like, doing the minor hockey, or she just play, like, two or three games a day. There's no wet, sweaty, like, yeah. It's just like, but, like, when you're young and you're a kid, you can just get away with it. But man. Still,
gross.
Ugh.
Anyways, back to the point. The reason I brought the bag skating is I've run playoffs and I've been to a bunch of team practices where the practice has just been, like, I get up there, I'm there to work with the goalies, and it's just, like, the first 20 minutes there's the bag skate, and I'm standing at the boards watching the goalies bag skate. And I asked you because I was really curious, like, as a goalie when I played, when our team got skated, like, I always felt like such a dummy being, like, the slowest person, like, just dragging behind everyone. Like, it's such a different experience of skating end-to-end in goalie gear than it is in player equipment that I still just struggle with it from ever, like, really making kids skate. I'm not a big make kids skate person. Sorry to everyone listening who likes that. I'm pretty not for it.
I'm a big push-up. Usually what we do is we'll do something, like, we'll play a game, and the losing team, yeah, push-ups or pick-up pucks.
Yeah, and, like, that's more, like, again, that's more fun. That's a little competition. It's different when it's, like, it's a competition setting, and, like, now you want to build that competitiveness. That's different than, like, punishment, right?
Yeah, no, it's to create a sense of urgency to put something on the line.
Yeah, exactly.
Some sort of degree of competition.
When we had Dr. Rob Gray on the podcast, that's exactly what one of the elements of representative practice is, like, having, like, a risk to performing poorly, right? Like, in the game, there's the risk is you lose, right? In a practice setting, you need to have, like, some sort of trade-off of, like, what happens if you don't perform. But I was just thinking about that, like, in terms of the conversation today, where it's like things coaches hopefully shouldn't do with goalies. Like, if you're going to skate your team, really think about what the goalies are doing in that skate. Just do me a favor, because if you're, like, yelling at them to hurry up and finish the skate, like, I promise you, they're probably trying.
They actually, most of the time, they're trying so hard.
It sucks being the last person. It feels terrible. You're like, everyone's done. And
I know. We don't want to be loud. Let us go first. You know?
Yeah.
Let the goalies just go first.
Yeah.
Like, everyone laughed them. But remember,
you got to skate to the bench.
You're like, yeah, but my skate to the bench is like 30 feet.
Yeah. It's
like, what I started to do is I would sometimes be allowed to do goalie stuff.
Yeah.
Where it would be like basically just little interval sprints where I'd be like, go to my, push my stick up, down, rest.
Yeah.
And, like, just get a burn that way. Because at least that there's hopefully going to be some carryover. We're working a little bit more specific muscles. And it's, if we're going to do something that's probably not the best, can we make it a little bit better? And so that's kind of where I was, you know, trying to get, you know, that was where my brain was thinking.
Yeah.
That also brings me to one other thing. And, you know, towards the end, and we're getting close to off-season training. And we're going to talk about off-season training and stuff as we go forward. Also, for those listening, we are going to move the podcast to every second week in the summer, just because it's a little bit more sustainable for us. And what we're going to try to do is to fill that time with interviews, and so that we can bank a lot of interviews for the season. And once the NHL is done, we won't really have as much to talk about. But come to off-season training, that video, the Winnipeg Jets making Lauren Brossoit slide with the band. I don't know how many people sent that to me. Oh, over 12 people. And they made us do that when I was with the Jets, and it wasn't like a hardcore thing. It was like, you just do like 10 reps. And it's so dumb. But the thing is, people see that and like, oh, well, Lauren Brossois and Hellebuck are doing it. That's therefore kids need to do that. And they've talked to us many times. I've made many videos about this on my social media. And I'm going to replay it. I'm going to repost them because I knew it. I worked hard on them and they deserve to be reposted. Two things. One, sometimes, like a lot of times, loading specific sports specific positions can actually be detrimental because we want them to be as specific as possible. And by adding in a load can actually change the pattern of movement, which we don't want. And this second thing is, just because they're doing it in the NHL doesn't mean you should do it there. They're already the best. It actually doesn't matter what they do at all. But what matters is, what can we look at what things worked and what didn't work for all the goalies ever that have tried to have been successful and get to the top level? And then we need to narrow down things and how can we adapt it to each individual goalie? A lot easier said than done. But instead of being like, oh, well, Thatcher Demko, I see on Instagram, Thatcher Demko is doing drills where they're shooting at his blocker and he's pushing to the glove and not watching and tracking pucks. Doesn't matter, man. He's just, Thatcher Demko can do whatever he wants because he's already in NHL. He's already one of the best goalies in the NHL. He's just taking shots to take shots. He's like you said, it's practice for maintenance.
Yeah, just maintenance practice. He's not trying to get
practice. He's not trying to get better because he's probably honestly not going to get that much better. So they can work at specific things if he's lacking. But again, just because they're in the NHL doesn't mean that you need to do what they're doing. You need to do things specific to yourself and your weaknesses. And that is what matters.
Jimmy, my biggest gripe with the video, I did see this Laurent Brossois video. No one sent it to me. So thank you everyone for not sending it to me. My biggest gripe is that he wasn't holding a medicine ball when he was doing
it. True. That if he was holding a medicine ball and did have skate weights on his ankles, it would have been way better.
That's actually, and that's the reason why he's the backup in Winnipeg, is he's not doing all he can be doing to get better.
and obviously we're being facetious, but it's cool to watch, it's cool to learn, but especially when it comes to like training and stuff, they're just at a different developmental level than most people listening to this podcast are. Although there are some pros that listen, but for the majority of our audience who are younger, minor hockey into junior hockey, they're just at a different place, and that's A-okay.
And also, again, and I know we kind of mentioned this, but I think the simple way of putting it is, you can do lots of different training things, and they just might not do anything, right? Like, pushing into a band, it might be a warm-up more than it's anything, development-wise, right? Like, it might just be a way to get the legs quickly burning, get a little muscle pump, and that's how they want to start their practice. Like, that's something that they do, and they want to do that. Maybe they want to create an early level of fatigue, and this is the most efficient way that they found to create a little bit of fatigue. Maybe that's the goal, right? You could, if that's the goal, you could replace that by just doing 30 T pushes back and forth, and you'd probably be about the same level of fatigue, right? So a lot of the times, without, we see these videos and things, we need to just be mindful of what the intent behind them might be and what the intent behind them should be before we implement anything into our own training. Just think about why you're
doing
it.
What that gets me too is that you look at something, you examine the literature. The strength coach isn't making them do that. I know Wolfie there, and Wolfie is a great strength coach, and he's never once hopped on the ice and made us do anything. It's the goalie coach. It's more of just he's not doing it for any right or reason. He's just doing it to do it. And that's A-okay again, because they're in the national level.
Yeah.
The National Hockey League, the best in the world. But you look at strength training literature, we know that overspeed training can be beneficial.
Sure can.
But you never see that. It's always
the resistance training. Yeah.
And it's never for we know that resistance training, that initial acceleration can be beneficial for creating that strength. Throwing the technique out the window, which is basically our biggest right, because ice is very expensive. And if you would rather you be doing specific things with that expensive ice, when you can get the same benefit and the same stuff off the ice, that's a lot of things where we're coming from. But you never see him do overspeed.
Well, so what you're saying is we should be putting rocket packs on our goalies.
Rocket pack. Then we need to have this ice slightly downhill and then have them power push as fast as they can. Or it's just, but again, it's just like,
Can we get any goalie fartlek training going?
But again, like a lot of goalie coaches aren't strength coaches, and that's okay.
Yeah,
I mean, that's why strength coaches and goalie coaches exist separately of each other. And sometimes goalie coaches and strength coaches overlap. But again, you gotta think about it. If how much is you're spending $300 for the hour on ice, or you can spend $50 in the gym. It's just like I'd rather do a lot of like tracking and like technique, like positional stuff, and then still get stronger, more explosive in the gym.
Yeah.
Unless you have a lot of money and you want to do whatever you want, then do whatever you want.
Well, exactly. That's always the case. Yeah. At the end of the day, I think just be smart with it. Right. And I think, again, in a roundabout way, that was our theme for this episode, which is just be smart from a coaching perspective, be smart with the communication with goalies, things we shouldn't do. And if these things are happening to you as a goalie, again, I've said this before, be your own advocate, right? If you're a goalie who's like, your coach isn't telling you, it's not really helpful to go whine and complain to someone. And I get it. I'm a big whiner and a big complainer. I can self-identify as that. But if you're having a hard time with coaches, and this is really hard, it's a really hard thing to do, but go talk to them and go try and be your own advocate. If you're a younger goalie, it might be like, hey, go and talk to the coach, bring your parent with you. And if you're a parent, don't do it just as yourself, as just the parent, bring your kid with you. Right? Like those are really valuable things. Advocate, have your, you know, as a goalie, advocate for yourself, do it respectfully. Don't assume that your coach is doing something maliciously. Mm-hmm. You need to advocate for yourself and advocate for your, especially as a goalie tandem, but you're not going to get anywhere like whining, complaining, and making offhand comments. You're going to get a lot of traction and get a lot of respect from coaches by having a real conversation with them. Being like, hey, we appreciate you're making your mind up. Like, we know you're deciding, but we'll play better if we know what's going on. Like, we will. Like, we'll be better. And if you want your team to win, you want your goalies to be better. So
exactly. All right. Thank you, everybody, for listening.
Hold on. Do you have a gripe of the week? Do you have any other gripes?
No, that was my gripe. I had another gripe, which you talked about, which is like RVH collapsing your hand and exposing your wrist to the shot instead of just opening up. So if you want to break your wrist, do that. Still not sure why it's being taught. It doesn't make any sense.
Jamie,
but that's my
I got a gripe of the week so much as a interesting development of the week. How much Shesterkin do you watch in your spare time?
Probably not enough, but more than most goalies.
You notice he throws a blocker side BH like more
all the time.
All the time than zero.
I watch him because he's one of the few goalies that still will keep their knee off the ground and it's good. And then when they make a hassle save because he makes that save where a lot of times guys would get beat. So I usually watch that clip back so I can cut it for examples.
Yeah.
But yeah, he loves block side RVH.
No, block side VH.
Sorry, VH. And it's usually a dynamic position. Yeah, like
it's on a retreat. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is pretty good. So
it's, again, it's for sure something I used to use when like a guy's coming on a sharp angle and like
is that because that's because the RVH literally was not invented.
I have like film from between 2011. It's actually interesting. I have film from 2011 through 2013 that I used as part of like going to college, and like game tape from back then. And there's no RVHs. It's straight VHs. And then
I remember the first time I was taught an RVH, I told the coach. It was in Calgary, that World Pro Goaltending in Calgary. I said, this is dumb and no one's ever going to use this. And boy, was I wrong.
You must have been at Tech when that happened, I would imagine.
No, I was playing Junior B. That was just towards the last. So that was me between going from Junior B to Junior A.
Really?
So that would have been 2012 or 13. No, sorry.
You're bad at math. That was in 10, 11.
But no, that would have been 10, 11. And yes, 10, 11.
Either way. 9, 10? This isn't a math podcast.
Yeah, it would have been
doesn't matter. The point is the timeline makes sense because I would say the RVH slowly developed and then became mainstream in like 2013-14 range. Because I remember I started using it in college.
I also started using it in college and we started practicing it with Boosh around that time.
Yes.
So I ended up learning it and I was like, this is dumb. And then the feedback from the camp was, his hips are too tight to be successful. And only half of that was correct. And it was my hips being too tight.
Yeah. At no point did it consider that, like, the funny thing, this is maybe a behind the peak scenes for people who listen to the very end of this podcast. Obviously, Jamie and I have known each other for almost 20 years now.
Wow.
That's a long time, man.
It is a long time.
But I have never seen someone, never in my life to this day, more dedicated to trying to become more mobile than you between ages like 15 through 21. And then like 21 hit and you're like, yeah, it's just not really happening. Like, this is it.
Yeah. I tried really, really
so hard. Like,
really
I,
hard.
You used to sit in the splits machine for hours.
I know. I actually, to be fair, I did get reasonably flexible. But just
like within more anatomy, like within,
yeah, I got as flexible as my anatomy would let me get.
Right. And again, like going back and watching you, like even at the end of your career, when you were like as flexible and as mobile as you're going to be, I would say like pretty bottom tier for professional goalie mobility.
Oh, 100%.
But the point being, again, and we always say this, like you need to try, like you put in the work, it made you a better goalie, right? You pushed your own limits.
Yeah.
Right. But it's just like, it's not as if like people who can't do that aren't trying to do it. That's kind of my point. I guess.
Yes. Agreed.
So long story short, the Broncos have VH is alive and well in a dynamic position from Shesterkin. And I also saw him, I was watching tape of him today. I saw him windmill a glove save and just didn't catch the puck. He just punched it in the air 400 feet.
Doesn't matter what they do. They're in the NHL.
He rocks. He's so fun to watch. Anyways, the point of this whole ramble is to say that if you haven't liked and subscribed on this video, what are you doing? It's YouTube. It's the podcast. Do it. Also, while you're liking and subscribing, then you unsubscribe and resubscribe. Also, subscribe to Jamie's Patreon because you're already clicking buttons and putting your credit card information in there, and you should do that some more.
And there's a lot of good videos coming up, too. I actually, in the last month, I've been putting up a lot of videos. So if you're on the Patreon, it's $10 a month. Helps support myself. It also supports the pod because that money from there goes to our little expenses that we have for the pod.
It does not go to help. It does not go to help Ben. I'll tell you.
It does not go to help Ben, but that's because Ben is Ben made his life choices.
there we go. Did you didn't listen to the solo episode I did last week? This was your chance.
I did not know.
No. Over the end, there is a Oscars worthy plug for your Patreon. At the end, I poured my heart and soul into it.
Hey, and you know what? I appreciate that.
I appreciate you.
Okay. All right. We'll see everybody next week.
Until next time.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.